Welcome back to New Books in Political Science. My name is Heath Brown, and I have the real pleasure to talk to Paul Brian McInerney about his really interesting new book, From Social Movement to Moral Market, How the Circuit Riders Sparked an IT Revolution and Created a Technology Market. Paul Brian, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for bringing me on today.
Yeah, it's a real pleasure. A very interesting book, a timely book, a book that spans a couple of different disciplines. Before we get to it, maybe you could tell us just a little bit about your academic background and where you are now.
Sure. I am an assistant professor in the Department of Sociology at the University of Illinois at Chicago. My background is in economic sociology, organizational sociology, social movements, and technology, which is sort of a weird combination of things that really does come out in the book when you see how everything comes together. I grew up in New York and did my undergraduate work at St. John's University, which at the time had quite a rivalry with Seton Hall on the basketball court. Did my graduate work at Columbia University.
Well, I could say that rivalry hasn't gone away, and probably by the time we're posting this, we'll be in the middle of the Big East tournament,
right.
So hopefully a game is about to occur. I wanted to start talking about the book by actually talking about some of what you mentioned in your preface. I enjoyed your preface and what you had to say about your own rebellious youth.
Mm.
So how did your time in the punk music scene, it sounds like the punk music scene in New York, motivate this book, if at all?
So I was always interested, and I mentioned this in the preface really briefly. It was a very tight-knit scene, so we had a lot of friends and bands. And so I understood from the inside working of those bands how hard it was to get by. And when folks had the opportunity to sign with a major label, to actually make money from their music, it was a really difficult time in integrating that with the overall ethos of the punk movement, which was generally to avoid the mainstream, stay out of the mainstream. At the same time, you couldn't begrudge these bands who you're friends for wanting to make money doing the things that they loved, and they put in the time. And so these kinds of conversations, we'd always engage in these really deep conversations about exactly this. Again, and the stakes were very, very low. So it's not like any of the people I knew went on to become the next big thing or anything. So what really drove my early interest in questions about things like, authenticity and how do groups maintain boundaries around authenticity and who's a part of the group and who doesn't get to be a part of the group anymore, were very much informed by those early experiences. I think I knew enough about doing academic work to know that I should love what I study, but not necessarily study what I love. So The thought did cross my mind that I should study this kind of phenomena in the punk rock scene, but then I was afraid that then it would demystify that entire world for me. And so I was very fortunate when I had the opportunity to look at how these problems manifested themselves within a entirely different set of political and moral questions, right, revolving around technology and the social and larger social goods.
Yeah, I think it's just what you're describing. So many first-time book authors struggle with, which is how close to get to the subject matter.
Right.
Your book begins in the mid 1990s.
Mm-hmm.
So what did the landscape of technology look like for nonprofit organizations at that point? Were many organizations connected to the Internet? It feels like, on the one hand, a long time ago, but on the other hand, not that long ago. So take us to that time period that you begin your study. What was the world that these activists and people interested in IT looking at when it came to the nonprofit sector?
Okay. The other part of my intellectual background, which didn't make it into the book, is I originally went to grad school to study the new media industry in New York City, Silicon Alley. So I was interested in those high-tech firms and did some background research into those high-tech firms when I was doing, particularly when I was doing my master's degree. And so I had a sense of the techno-utopianism that was happening during the early to mid-90s in the for-profit high-tech sector. When I got the opportunity to meet up with folks doing this kind of work in the nonprofit sector, the differences were very stark. People in the nonprofit sector were really concerned at the time with doing really simple things like getting online, like creating membership databases. I mean, things that nowadays ordinary people do all the time when they generate lists from their contacts on their computer to print out labels for their Christmas card. Things that we take for granted now were kind of a challenge back in the 90s to organize. And these nonprofits, which were resource poor and had to dedicate much of their funding toward accomplishing their missions, technology was really ancillary. It really wasn't a major part of what they were trying to do. And so when I talked to the Circuit Riders, which was the social movement in the book, about what their work was like in those early days, a lot of it was climbing under desks and running wires and doing things that, again, we take for granted, like connecting printers to multiple computers, which is something is very easy to do now with the ubiquity of wireless routers and Wi-Fi in your home, but at the time was kind of complicated. And so the nonprofit sector really did need some people to champion technology and to help lead them across what they call the organizational divide.
Yeah, and it seems that your book is a lot about just this issue, which is how we understand problems mm-hmm. and how problems are conceived of. So in this case, one of the debates was whether this issue was primarily a private problem of certain organizations mm-hmm. or really a social problem.
Yes.
So I wonder how some of the key individuals and groups of that time period first conceptualized this situation. How did they seek to explain the problem that they saw?
Yeah, so this to me is the fascinating point, the part about approaching this as a social movements problem. Because I think it's a problem that all social movements face, and that is, how do you get other groups that may have a stake in what it is that you're trying to do, how do you give them a stake in what it is that you're trying to do, first of all, and how do you recruit them as adherents? And they don't have to be necessarily people that you're trying to mobilize as part of the movement, but they could be people who can provide other kinds of resources like legitimacy. And so the way that I think about it in the book is to think about how, as someone working in the nonprofit sector or somebody who wants to facilitate technological change in the nonprofit sector, how do you convince resource holders like foundation officers that technology is worth investing in, right? In the nonprofit sector, there are a variety of topics that are considered just inherently worthy, right? Homelessness, hunger, you can name any number of social problems. And that's not because there's anything inherently worthy about those problems, but there's a long institutional history of people working on those problems and making them worthwhile. Technology in the 1990s really posed a problem for these folks in the sense that how do you convince people like foundation officers that technology is worth the investment? And how they did it early on was to try to connect or associate information technology with the daily operations of a nonprofit, to really attach it to their mission and say, look, technology is not just wires and computers and printers. It's fundamental to what nonprofits are trying to accomplish. And so it really is a part of the mission. And I talk about this in the book as a series of associations that specific people in the movement that were trying to launch this movement made between information technology conceptually and the missions of the organizations that they were trying to help. And in packaging it this way and making this kind of association, they can bring it to, they can create a story, which I call an account. And by bringing these accounts, bringing these stories to foundation officers, they can get resources, get money needed to do this kind of work. And at one point it hit in the mid 90s with the W. Alton Jones Foundation, which funded basically a pilot study of their grantees. They said, okay, we're going to give you some money and you can go out and wire all of these grantees together. And at the time, the grantees were trying to work on problems around low and zero emissions vehicles in the 1990s. And what those early circuit riders did was go to the foundations and say, look, what you're trying to do is coordinate about 50 nonprofit organizations that are all working on the problem of emissions in automotive vehicles. And so how fundamental to this, to them solving this problem, is them communicating across these great distances. And so communications technologies is really fundamental to what it is that you're trying to accomplish. And the W. Alton Jones Foundation funded the earliest circuit riders to go out and connect these folks to the internet and connect them to one another to do the networking. And that early stud, that early pilot program was considered a huge success. For about $150,000, they connected about 50 organizations together and felt like they made a real dent in the problem of doing research around low emissions and zero emissions vehicles.
Yeah. So this, let's talk a little bit more about the circuit riders themselves. Mm-hmm. You mentioned a little bit about how they funded their operations.
Right.
But what inspired them? You tell the story of where they got their name.
Yes.
But so maybe you could talk a little bit about that, but also how that inspiration had an effect on the structure of their activities.
Okay.
The way in which they organize themselves is very important, particularly as we get to the next stage, which we'll talk about in just a little bit. So I wonder if you can talk about, you know, who are these people? Are we talking about hundreds of people? Or are we talking about more? What are the circuit riders?
So the earliest circuit riders were really just a handful of folks that were working toward this problem of they were... in some ways, you can think about them as geeks with a conscience. They were people with technology skills, but that rather than sell those technology skills on the open market, wanted to do something that had some kind of social or environmental impact. And the earliest circuit riders were only about 15 to 25 people that were scattered across the United States. This study that I mentioned, or the program rather that I mentioned that was started by W. Alton Jones Foundation, resulted in a report that was fairly widely circulated among different foundations as a way for foundations to get their grantees online, a cost-effective way for them to get their grantees online. And as that report circulated, other people obviously came across it. One person in particular, this guy by the name of Rob Stewart, who was sadly passed away just a couple of years ago, was trained as a community organizer in the public interest research group system, and thought this is a fantastic way to get nonprofit organizations online, and took it upon himself as an institutional entrepreneur, to organize a movement, to organize this, what he thought of as a disparate group of people, into some kind of cohesive collectivity. And by giving them, or you know, the circuit rider name came out of the early report and had more to do with the novelty of circuits than it did to the antebellum creatures of the time. But Rob Stewart really picked up this name and thought this is a great way to give this movement some cachet by identifying or attaching some kind of name to it. And then going around the country, which is what he did from his post at the Rockefeller Family Foundation, and talking to different nonprofit groups and different technology folks and saying, see, what you're doing is circuit riding, even though you're not calling it circuit riding. And he went around the country with basically a roadshow, an early PowerPoint presentation. Some of these presentations are still on online archives, and you can see them. They're kind of fascinating in how rudimentary they are. But he went around the country and basically proselytized, evangelized, and used this kind of language of evangelizing. So what's interesting about the name Circuit Riders is that even though it didn't start from the antebellum creatures, it took on that notion of evangelizing for technology or spreading the good word. And eventually what had happened is in order to connect these people, they started to organize conferences that they called Riders Roundups, really playing on this frontiers cowboy preacher thing. To get people together and give them face time. The first one was a meeting of about 15 of these circuit riders that took place actually where I am in Chicago.
Now, I wonder if we can talk about one of those conferences.
Sure.
One of the big ones. So without glossing over too much of the history, mm-hmm. we could say that things were going pretty well. But there was this seminal conference held in New York State in 1998 that really did shift the landscape
and
opened up space for the emergence of a new group and a new leader.
Yeah.
Would you tell us about that conference and what happened there and how it really did shift the direction of this movement in some significant ways?
Yeah. So one of the ways that Rob Stewart was able to enroll circuit riders so successfully was by appealing to their notions of social justice and environmental justice. And he really did take a lot of the techno-utopian language that was in the air during that. Remember, this is the time of the dot-com boom. So really, people thought that the internet was going to change the world. And specifically in change the way that markets operated. But Rob Stewart and the early circuit riders took these ideas and reframed them in this social movements aspect to think about technological revolution in a very different sense. They thought about revolution as both uses of the term, right? There's a technological revolution that's going to transform the technical aspects of how we do our work. But then there's this other revolutionary potential, and that is that once we've transformed the way that we do that work, people will be empowered to engage in social justice movements, in environmental justice movements, in ways that they hadn't been able to before, and really affect significant policy changes. And he used this rhetoric around revolutions and revolutionary and picked up a lot of the techno-utopian language and rhetoric to describe how technology, when channeled through the nonprofit sector, was going to change the world. So he organizes this meeting in upstate New York, the Rockefeller Conference Center in Keokuk, New York, because, again, he was a foundation fellow at the Rockefeller Family Fund, and so he had access to these the conference center. And he brings together a group of foundation officers, some of which had already been involved in funding circuit rider programs, and some of which who hadn't been involved in funding circuit rider programs. And they were, the ostensible plan was to develop a planning document to advance circuit riding, to make circuit riding the way that we did technology work in the nonprofit sector. Of the people who attended the meeting, Microsoft sent somebody who was doing some work with them in Seattle, looking at how it is that, so Microsoft had a fairly generous software donation program, and they were finding that very small volunteer organizations were asking for essentially enterprise-level software, which is high-level software that you would use to connect multiple servers or to service thousands of people, and they knew that they couldn't possibly be using this software for anything. So Microsoft commissioned a study to find out how people were using their software donation program, and the author of that study, a woman named Joan Fanning, came back to Microsoft and said, really, what needs to happen is we need to develop effectively consulting firms for the nonprofit sector to help them use software in ways that will help them better achieve their mission. And so Microsoft said, great, we're going to send you to this conference that we were invited to. And so they sent Joan Fanning to the conference at KaiCut. The turning point happens during the first day of the meeting when Rob Stewart stands in front of all these foundation officers and starts talking using this techno-utopian rhetoric. And the foundation officers who are while politically progressive and politically liberal, are fairly conservative when they think about how to spend foundation funds, were really put off by the revolutionary rhetoric. And they were even more put off by the fact that there was, in Joan Fanning's terms, not really a concrete action plan. And Joan Fanning being a very aware pragmatist, took advantage of this, the confusion in the situation, to stand up and say, okay, here's how we can turn this meeting around. Here's how we can make something of this early plan. And she took the reins in this particular meeting and said, hey, this is how we can make these ideas, and in her language, actionable. Here's something concrete that we can do. We can fund organizations like the organization that she wanted to start to help nonprofits figure out how to use software, which is a very different kind of rhetoric than saying, if we fund the circuit riders, we will generate radical social change. And the foundation officers, this actionable, concrete, pragmatic approach to solving the problems of the technological divide in the nonprofit sector really appealed to the foundation officers in the room, and they started channeling their attention, but more important, their resources toward Joan Fanning and her model of technology work, which became the organization called NPower.
So we have this sort of dramatic history, and I think everyone's sort of skin crawls when you think about what might have happened at this conference, and you can only imagine the conversations that happened sort of off stage,
right.
and you could fill in a lot of blanks. Probably most of those blanks didn't actually occur, right. But at least it does tell a very dramatic story.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
In the interest of time, what do you make of this story, this case study? I wonder if you can sort of draw for us a couple of conclusions.
Sure.
About how social movements work.
Mm-hmm.
About the influence, good or bad, of philanthropy.
Okay.
And sort of how you step back from this and try to make sense of this very detailed history that you tell in the book.
Yeah. So I think what it tells a couple of things, I think, about social movements and collective behavior. First, it really speaks to the importance of what I call in the book competences, which builds on a concept by a colleague in sociology, Neil Fligstein. He uses this term social skill to describe how it is that people may be empowered to challenge certain kinds of institutional arrangements. And so I add to that this notion of competence, this idea that when people are, you know, that people are informed and aware of the situations that they find themselves in, and people with social skill can take advantage of the knowledge that they have in those instances to alter the course of what ultimately becomes the course of the movement itself, although at the time it wasn't obvious that this was going to really radically change the direction of the movement. But what became fateful about this particular occasion was that Joan Fanning's confidence really refocused the attentions of the foundation officers in the room toward doing things in a much more conservative way. And so the thinking about the role of philanthropy, I mean, social movements studies has a long history of thinking about what are the roles of resources in allowing social movements to gain more adherence, to become ultimately successful. And money matters. Money matters quite a bit for these movements to be able to accomplish the goals that they need to accomplish or that they want to accomplish. And so foundation officers played sort of an outsourced or an outsized role in shaping the social movements by being decision makers around how these resources get spent, how they get distributed. And this moment in the history rechannels funding, material resources, and then even more important than the material resources, rechannels the legitimacy, the resource of legitimacy, away from the circuit riders and toward Joan Fanning and her new organization, NPower. Because with foundation funding, or foundation funding follows sort of what Rob Merton, an old functionalist sociologist, called the Matthew effect. And that is, you know, to whom, to those people who have much, much is given. And so by getting the legitimacy of a foundation behind you, which is how the circuit riders started, they could generate even more legitimacy and more funding for their model. And so subsequent to this meeting, you find some really interesting quotes that people gave me in interviews and elsewhere around how Joan Fanning really saved the meeting, but more important, really saved the movement. But as we see throughout the rest of the history, that movement takes a very different direction after that meeting, right? It because a new model becomes legitimated in this particular meeting.
Yeah, as you describe, and I think as anyone listening can tell, there's just a lot to learn from your book, I think, for scholars, but as related to that, for practitioners.
Yeah.
You know, I think that there isn't enough writing, serious writing, by academics that really can be consumed by practitioners, people who are involved in these kinds of organizations, people who are involved in social movements. And it's for that reason, I think, that there is a real wide audience for the book. I enjoyed it a lot. What's next for you? What do you have a new project brewing? This is a very recent release.
Yeah.
But do you have something next? Are you going to stay in this technology realm, or are you going to shift into back into the punk movement of the 1990s? Tell us what's on your desk now.
Sure, I have two projects going, and not to play too much on the pun of brewing. One actually has to do with microbrewers. Fundamentally, I've been always interested in how these different kinds of social and economic values blend together over time. And so one of the things that I found dissatisfying about some of the early social movements literature is that they painted people as either being black or white, as being on one side or the other. And in the book, the circuit riders move back and forth and NPower moves back and forth, and no actor is distinctly on one side or another. So we generate this world full of hybrids. And so the work that I'm doing now focuses on new forms of hybridity. And so I'm looking at new forms of hybridity between social and market values in two different settings. The first is among the microbrewery movement, where I'm interested in this interesting puzzle to me, at least, that you microbrewers work off of an apprenticeship model, which means that they generate their future competition. And at the same time, they engage in these collaborations with other microbrewers to produce these one-off beer styles. And so I wondered why it is that in a competitive market like the microbrewing industry, which is a very small part of the beer business, would organizations sow the seeds of their own competition and then furthermore collaborate with their competitors? And so I want to know a little bit more about what the dynamics are behind that amalgamation of competition and collaboration at the same time. And I'm doing a similar project in farmers markets in Chicago, where I'm looking at how different kinds of social and market values are combined and recombined in the things that people sell at farmers markets. So farmers markets are really an attempt at decommodifying food, right? Trying to say that there's something more to this food, that, you know, you're spending extra money on this food because you're getting something more than just simply the nutrition. You're getting something organic, you're getting something local. And how do we combine those ideas with something that's ultimately for sale in a marketplace?
Well, I'd have to say it sounds like you have chosen very wisely in your next two projects. They sound like they're very natural outgrowths of the current book, and I hope you come back with whatever comes of these two projects. Until then, we have your current book published this year by Stanford University Press, From Social Movement to Moral Market, How the Circuit Riders Sparked an IT Revolution and Created a Technology Market. Paul Bryant, thank you very much for your time today.
Thanks so much, Heath.